for causes, one of the things that I did in 2009 was actually draft a piece of legislation that made it easier for college students in Arizona to register to vote on campus. Because when we engage students in these nonpartisan ways and get everyone registered to vote and everyone express their opinion at the ballot box, I think it's a constructive way to get everyone to move forward. So I've been focused on higher education because it's just, I think, the key to moving everything forward.
And, Daniel, that this tragedy should occur in your hometown in Tucson, Arizona once again being the focus of national attention in a not in a positive way in terms of this this shooting, but the and as a Latino, your sense, many people around the country now look at Arizona as the new Mississippi, that so much intolerance seems to have developed there among even among top leaders in the state. And the move against teaching of ethnic studies in Arizona, the Senate bill, the Show Me Your Papers law, and the efforts now of Russell Pierce to attempt to have legislation against citizenship in Arizona for what he calls anchor babies. Your sense of how this tragedy may affect how the people of Arizona see how their state is the image of the state across the country.
Although I do agree that Arizona has probably has been at the forefront of the negative rhetoric, it's been both sides. So I'm not going to say that either side has had their hands clean of it. Of course, in Arizona, there's one party that has more of a platform because they have more power in elected office. But I think it's not just something that's going to be happening in Arizona. I think it's something that's going to be happening nationwide, which is I'm moving forward with the political discourse, and I'm under no illusions that it's going to happen overnight, but I definitely see a gradual move towards more constructive political discourse, because even at the State of the State that the governor gave, where she recognized myself and others, she made a promise to kind of take a look at some of the rhetoric that's been used in the past in order to move forward and trying to work cooperatively. And I know that those promises are being made in a sensitive time, but I really do hope that for the best for Arizona and for the country, that they will hold true to their promises, because it's being both sides that are making these promises. And I think a lot of people are realizing that the political discourse has for years become completely destructive and more about tearing the other people apart instead of trying to work together to build up the nation and the state.
Were you a supporter, Danny Hernandez, of the DREAM Act, as you talk about the focus on higher education, immigrants being able to become citizens who go to college?
Some of the work that I'd done with the higher education advocacy group was centered around trying to get the DREAM Act passed, which we worked closely with Congresswoman Giffords and Gabe Zimmerman, her outreach director, as well as Ann Kirkpatrick and Harry Mitchell of Arizona when they were still in the Congress. So it's, of course, something that I had supported, but it's something that, like I said, issues that Gabby and I were really close on in terms of our beliefs.
You know, we're moving into Martin Luther King Day weekend, honoring his birthday, Arizona, one of the last states to recognize it. You certainly, in your own actions, have made such a difference in representing diversity, beauty and love in your state. Final thoughts that you have on this weekend?
I think that the actions that one person took will not be able to define who Arizonans, Tucsonans, or Americans are. And I think we are coming together as one big American family, like the president said, that's 300-plus million members strong, to support those who have lost family members, unfortunately, and also those who have still remained in the hospital in critical condition. So I think as we move forward, it's important to support them as one big family instead of trying to define what is the
Danny Hernandez, thank you so much. Martin Luther King special on Monday. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 8 a.m. Stay tuned next for Talk Radio. Per Fagering hosts this morning and will speak with William Hartung of the New America Foundation about his book, Prophets of War, which exposes Lockheed Martin, America's largest military contractor, coming up right after these announcements.
KBOO is a proud media sponsor of Organicology, the study of a sustainable food future. Learn skills and meet organic pioneers while exploring the organic trade from soil to seed to table with intensives, workshops, trade show, and celebration. At Organicology, the study of a sustainable food future, February 10th through 12th at the DoubleTree Lloyd Center in Portland. Jim Hightower, Andrew Kimbrell, and Stephen Jones keynote this event, hosted by Oregon TILF, the FTSLA, Organic Seed Alliance, and Organically Grown Company. For registration and details, see www.organicology.org or kboo.fm/organic.
KBOO is a proud sponsor for the Human Rights Campaign's fundraiser at Lola's Room at the Crystal Ballroom. This event will be on Sunday, January 16th at 7 p.m. and will feature KBOO's DJ Anjali. There will be a silent auction and Bhangra dance lessons. For more information, please visit the website portland.hrc.org.
Well, good morning. This is Friday Talk Radio. My name is Per Fogring, and our guest is William Hartung, who is here. He has a book out called Prophets of War, all about Lockheed Martin. I'd like to make a little announcement first. Of course, Monday is the day they celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday, and it's also the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the Prime Minister of Congo. And you can say, in a way, those two items are connected. Both King and Lumumba had their visions for their country, and both were assassinated. Lumumba was assassinated. He was killed by the Belgian and their sort of little puppet regime in eastern Congo, Katanga, and 50 years ago, Monday, and Congo has never been the same since. Anyway, now back to our show. We have William Hartung here. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Well, he's going to be tonight at Powell's, 10th and Burnside, the main store, tonight at 7:30. And I think I would get there a little early, may fill up. But anyway, it's he'll be at Powell's tonight talking about his book, Prophets of War, all about Lockheed. So why don't we go in a little bit of history about Lockheed? It was very interesting. It started out, I mean, back in the old days of aviation, where things are pretty kind of like seat of the pants flying in little small outfits, you know, guys used to build their own planes and start plane companies.
Yeah, there was two brothers, Alan and Malcolm. They originally spelled their name L-O-U-G-H-E-A-D, but Alan said that people kept calling him Lughead instead of Lockheed, so he changed the spelling at a certain point. But they were very taken with the Wright brothers' achievements, and there was another aviation figure called John Montgomery who started with gliders and then went from there. So Malcolm also had an interest in autos, and he used some of those same skills when they built their first plane, which happened in 1916, essentially in a garage in San Francisco. And they used that plane to take people on sort of joyrides around San Francisco Bay for $5, sometimes $10 a ride. And they used that to raise their original money to build the, you know, the planes that came after that. So Alan was also sort of a barnstorming pilot until he crashed at one of these shows, and his wife said, you know, no more of that. So he would only fly when he had a particularly sort of potentially lucrative customer, but no more just, you know, going around to every show that, you know, he could get to.
Well, that was a long time ago, and of course, now Lockheed is the biggest defense contractor, and they've really branched out. So why don't we, they started basically around the time of the First World War.
Yes, and they kind of missed the boat on that. I mean, they didn't make any major planes for the war. They did make a few planes that were designs from another company that the Army, you know, threw at them as kind of a beginning. of working on military planes. And then after the war, there was a drop-off, and they were on the verge of going bankrupt. And Malcolm said, you know, I can't take this. You know, it's too nerve-wracking. So he went back into the auto industry, developed hydraulic brakes, which were used for many years, you know, his version of them. And Alan stuck with it. But, you know, he still was sort of limping along. And then in 1926, the first version of the company went bankrupt. He bounced back, got some new investors. They built a plane called the Vega, which had some customers. And they, you know, doubled their profits, you know, small though they were, in a couple of years. But then they were bought up by this other company called the Detroit Aircraft Corporation, which was investors from General Motors and the Ford Motor Company. And they were going to build this into what they called the General Motors of the Air. They wanted to be the biggest aviation company in the country. But, you know, they were starting at a bad time because it was the beginning of the Depression. They, too, went under. And then a young financier named Robert Gross bought them for $40,000. He was competing with a scrap company that bid the same amount. But he convinced the bankruptcy judge that he would try to do something productive with the assets. So the judge, you know, favored his bid but said, I hope you know what you're doing, young man, because he really didn't see a lot of prospects for the company, you know, really moving forward in any kind of substantial positive way.
So what was aviation like in those days? How many planes did Lockheed have in those days?
Well, you know, when they started, they actually had one. And, you know, they when they crashed it, when the investors took it back from them and locked it up in a garage in San Francisco.
So there's no more company then.
And then they raised a little money to buy it back from the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the numbers increased. You know, they'd sell maybe a dozen a year. But it was, you know, pretty much seat of the pants economically.
And so, I mean, you know, people were flying around in those days back in the 30s, you know. They'd, of course, it was sort of a mode of travel for people who had money.
Yeah, there were beginnings of the airlines, and Lockheed sold to them to a certain degree. They built an aircraft called the Electra, which almost put them under, but once they got it going, they had some significant sales to a couple early airlines, and it was transformed later in the 30s into one of the first bombers, and then they sold that to the British when the British were up against it at the beginning of World War II. Eventually sold them about 1,700 of those, so that was a huge number for those days, and it made them from sort of a small struggling company into the biggest company in the aircraft industry.
So that was kind of like the turning point then.
That was really what made them, you know, the beginnings of what they are now, the large company that's, you know, got a leg up on the competition.
Well, you mentioned in your book that in World War One they actually had cost-plus contracts.
Yes.
Tell us what those are, you know.
Well, basically it's a great deal for the company because whatever your costs are, you get a percentage profit on top of that. So if you run cost overruns, you make more money than if you come in as estimated. So it's really almost an invitation to steal, or at least to engage in, you know, shoddy practices. And that method has, you know, come and gone. It's existed in various forms, even up till today.
Did they have to document their costs very much, or was it kind of?
It was pretty
trust.
Pretty free and easy. You know, I mean, now the Pentagon has auditors, and they're supposed to, you know, ferret out waste and so forth. But even so, the numbers of auditors have been going down, even as the amounts of money have been going up. So it's difficult for even a, you know, a conscientious auditor to keep track of all the stuff that's happening with all the contractors.
But basically, the principle sort of is that the higher your costs, the more money you make, the more profit you make.
Yeah, so it's a good deal if you can get it. You know, I mean, that doesn't work that way in my business.
and this continues today. And this is sort of what they do now with the Pentagon contractors.
Yeah, sometimes they'll cut a deal where if there's a cost overrun, the company will pick up part of it and the Pentagon will eat the majority of it. So, you know, they've tinkered with it, but there's still a strong emphasis on you know, variations of that kind of contract.
So then during World War II, Well, they sold a lot of planes to the Brits, and they sell a lot of planes to the U.S. Air Force.
Well, they built a fighter called the P-38, and they sold 10,000 of them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is the most successful plane that they've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they really, you know, grew tremendously. You know, they had a few thousand employees in the late 30s, and by 1943 they had 91,000. So they were scouring the area for labor to build these things. They had unemployed actors. They had people who had come from the Dust Bowl. They had, you know, teenage kids working on them. In a way, it's surprising that they did as well as they did with the kind of surge of production they needed to do, and the fact that it was a very new industry and people, you know, came without the knowledge initially of building aircraft.
And do they sell civilian airliners too, or is it mainly warplanes?
Well, initially they had a role in the civilian market. Starting in the 40s, they had a plane called the Constellation.
Mm-hmm.
And they nicknamed it the Connie. And it sold a little bit during World War II, and then, you know, pretty substantial sales in the 50s. But that was the last really successful airliner that they had. They started in the 60s building the L-1011, which, you know, was used by a number of airlines, but they ran into cost troubles, and they were, you know, losing out to Boeing on a lot of their contracts. So, you know, by the 70s, they were kind of, you know, really in a crisis over whether they could stay in the commercial airline business.
So then after the war ended, things looked a little bleak for them.
Yes, Robert Gross, who was then the head of the company, wrote to a colleague, "I will never forget those short, appalling weeks, you know, right after the war." So it wasn't that he was appalled by the war per se. He was really appalled by the end of the war and what it meant, you know, economically for his company. And in fact, even during the war, when Hitler was marching across Europe, he wrote to another colleague, you know, it makes me really sad that we're losing all these markets. You know, we cultivated markets in Romania and Yugoslavia and other parts of East and Central Europe, and now Hitler's ruining it, you know, by overthrowing the governments there. So, you know, they were getting huge contracts from the U.S. government, and of course, the issue of Hitler was a lot more important than, you know, whether he was, you know, cutting out a few small markets for an aviation company. But there was kind of this narrow business focus that Gross had, you know, partly because he had rescued the company from bankruptcy, and in the 30s, you know, they were barely making it till the end of the decade. So it was almost like an amoral approach, you know, where he really sort of felt like they had to do whatever they had to do to sell airplanes.
So then the Cold War started. I sort of remember that from when I was a kid. You know, it was like a real turnaround because, you know, during the war, you go to the movies and see newsreels of the Red Army, you know, beating back the Nazis and everything. And then after the war, all of a sudden, it seemed a real sudden change. All of a sudden, the Russians were no longer our allies. They were our enemies.
Well, it was a real boon to the companies.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, certainly went along with this, and they did some of their own propaganda. Gross gave some talks, you know, at the time of the Korean War, where he said, you know, we're going to have to defend freedom everywhere in the world, and therefore we need to be able to get men and material, weapons and, you know, fuel to anywhere on the globe on short notice. So we need fast transport from the air. So he's sort of doing an advertisement for their own planes and saying, you know, in essence, if you want to be the global policeman, you're going to need Lockheed to help make it happen. So they, you know, the Korean War really was kind of another turning point in the sense that it brought them back from the brink of disaster from the build down after World War II. And they also, they helped create some blue ribbon commissions like the Finletter Commission, which advocated for 80% increase in military spending, tripling the number of planes that the Pentagon bought. And, he kind of pitched it as this kind of independent citizens committee that would look at the future of aircraft industry and how it affected our economy and our national defense, our technological lead in the world. But they had 150 witnesses testify. 149 of them were either from the aircraft industry or the Air Force, the Army Air Corps. And so it really was kind of a technique that they've used over the years to kind of use kind of a almost these advisory panels as a front group to push their interests without them, you know, their fingerprints being seen by a lot of the public.
So then after the Korean War, I guess it was a little lull, of the Vietnam War was pretty soon after that.
Yeah, they had some business in the 50s. They built the U-2 spy plane for the CIA. They created the Polaris submarine launch ballistic missile. They made some money on transport planes like the C-130. So they did reasonably well. You know, Eisenhower sort of did some battle with the Pentagon and the industry to try to, you know, at least curb the rate of increase of military spending. And even, you know, after Sputnik, he was trying to hold things steady. And of course, his vice president, Richard Nixon, got hammered for that by John F. Kennedy, who said that the Eisenhower administration had allowed a dangerous missile gap to develop between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, which ended up not being the case. In fact, the U.S. had far more ballistic missiles than the Soviets did. But so it was ironic that Eisenhower and Nixon were painted as kind of soft on communism. Mm-hmm. And, but even in that climate, which wasn't, you know, huge, you know, astounding growth as there was in some other periods, Lockheed did reasonably well because they were involved in, you know, all aspects of the emergence of the aerospace industry. So not just aircraft, but missiles. And the U-2 was a, you know, a new kind of aircraft that hadn't really been envisioned before.
Well, you mentioned in the book that the U-2, you know, was a spy plane that took all these pictures of inside the Soviet Union, and it apparently showed that the Soviet Union was overrated as a military power.
That's right, and Eisenhower was kind of unwilling to reveal that information. He didn't want to know, let the Soviets know how much we knew. Mm-hmm. But as a result, he allowed the bomber lobby and the missile lobby to really run rampant because he wasn't really refuting a lot of these exaggerated claims that they were making. You know, so things like the Polaris, they built, you know, 650 of them within about a 5 to 7 year period. So that was a huge moneymaker for Lockheed.
And that was a missile, right?
Yes, it launched mm-hmm. from submarines. It was the first mm-hmm. Missile that could, you know, reach the Soviet Union that was not land-based. And it was a complicated thing to create them. Initially, they were going to take the land-based missiles and use them, but they found out they would have to use an amazingly huge submarine to do that, and it was impractical. So they developed a whole new weapon to go with the submarines.
How much did one of those cost?
You know, back then, I would think, you know, that's a good question. I'm trying to think of the 650 they built. They spent, you know, a few billion dollars on it. So, you know, certainly far, far less than they're spending now. You know, maybe, you know, less than $100 million each, whereas today they might be a billion or more.
For one missile.
Yeah.
That's really strange, you know?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the purpose of the missiles was to end life as we know it. So mm-hmm. we were spending a lot of money to put ourselves at risk.
So then by the end of the Carter administration, military spending was down again, wasn't it? Or
yeah. I mean, the 60s with the war was a great growth period. Mm-hmm. Lockheed Martin got in a lot of trouble because one of its transport planes, the C-5, had huge cost overruns and couldn't do the mission that it was, you know, built for. And then, you know, through the, as the war wound down and Carter came into office, they actually got to the point where the military budget was about where it had been before Eisenhower came in. So again, the industry felt like it was back on its heels a little bit, and they had to lobby, you know, to get things sort of back to what they were used to, that, you know, to be supported in the style to which they were accustomed.
Then along comes Ronald Reagan.
Reagan to the rescue. And, you know, he had the biggest peacetime buildup in, you know, the post-war history of the United States. And Lockheed Martin's contracts doubled within the first couple years of the Reagan administration because he, you know, you may remember Reagan was talking about the evil empire and mm-hmm. we were lagging dangerously behind the Soviets. And he put a big emphasis on building up the nuclear arsenal. And so the follow-on to the Polaris was the Trident submarine launched ballistic missile, which was also built by Lockheed. So they made a lot of money on that, on transport aircraft. They got in trouble because they were the origins of things like the $600 toilet seat and the $7,600 coffee maker.
Mm-hmm.
So their business practices, you know, came to have a rather poor reputation. It helped some of the advocates of lower Pentagon spending because it was something that people could understand. You know, if they spend $435 on a hammer that you could get for $7 in the hardware store, people knew something was wrong. These companies were basically profiteering off of the military budget.
Well, now, is Lockheed, are they sort of located and based in any one state? Are they a California company or not?
Well, they started in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Now they claim to be in 46 states. Mm-hmm. I think they may be stretching that, but they have big. They're big in Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, where they build F-16 fighters, among other things. They're big in Marietta, Georgia, and Orlando, Florida. They've got some work in New York State. You know, so they've got a number of kind of big hubs, and then they have subcontractors who are spread out around the country. And in fact, sometimes they place their factories in the districts of powerful members of Congress so that they mm-hmm. can get them on their side.
Yeah, I was going to talk about it. This is sort of Pentagon strategy or military industrial strategy. They have some kind of presence everywhere around the country. So every congressional district has some reason for, you know, for voting for more military spending.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, even when the industry loses a fight, you can see that effect. The Obama administration stopped the F-22 combat aircraft at about 187, but the Air Force wanted about 250 of them. And but the vote was such that everybody who voted to keep it had Lockheed plants in their district, and everybody who voted against it had no Lockheed facilities of any significant type. So it really sort of broke down in terms of not liberal or conservative, but really pork barrel interests who had the Lockheed presence in their states and districts.
Yeah, you mentioned this one time in the book. There was one of these spending battles, and let's see, we're switching microphones here, but the 17 Republicans voted against the military spending, including a lot of conservatives, and something like 22 Democrats voted for the military spending, including Hubert Humphrey and the liberals. And it was based on, the money that was going into their districts.
Yeah, you know, with a few exceptions. You know, when they tried to bail out the company in the early 70s, Humphrey took a position in favor of the company because of the jobs argument, as did Alan Cranston of California. But then you had people like James Buckley, conservative from New York State, who basically said, you know, this is not capitalism as it should be. You know, if the company's not managed well, we should let it fail. But, of course, there's never really been capitalism in the military industry to speak of. Also, William Proxmire, who led the fight against the bailout, had limited